Hey now, I'm Sean Quinn, and today I'm joined by the co-executive producer of the UX Advantage Conference, Jared Spool, who along with Karen McGrain has been working really hard on putting together a conference focusing on the UX strategy issues that no one else is talking about. In this podcast, we'll dive into two of the UX Advantage topics, the role of the Yes Lawyer and incentives and rewards. How are you doing, Jared?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing, Sean?
Great. I'm excited to talk about some of these topics with you, learn more about them, and be able to share the information with all the folks out there who may be interested in learning more about it.
I am equally as excited.
All right.
Using UX as a competitive advantage is what UX Advantage is all about. Karen McGrain and Jared Spool interview design leaders on what they do to instill UX within their corporate DNA. Explore the conference at uxadvantage.com.
So let's start with this concept of the Yes Lawyer. One of the topics that'll be covered at the UX Advantage conference is inventing the Yes Lawyer. And I was wondering if you would take a few minutes to explain what a Yes Lawyer is and how they partner up or the role they play in UX design.
So people who have worked in business in any way have encountered no lawyers. No lawyers are lawyers whose job it is to basically say no. You know, you try and do something interesting and they say, unfortunately, we can't do that. We can't do that because the regulations prevent us. We can't do that because the rules don't let us do that. We have to put this out to RFP. We have to write the RFPs a certain way. And those folks, there are many of them. They're everywhere. But the problem is that they actually get in the way. And particularly when you're working in a regulated industry or you're trying to do something interesting with an organization that you want to hire, we run into these problems of these lawyers just sort of stopping progress. And a few months ago, I was talking to somebody over at the U.S. Digital Service, and she was very excited about the fact that what they've done is they've decided to bring legal staff into the digital service itself and tackle these no problems from the very beginning and to have the lawyers understand what it is you're trying to do. And she said, we have lawyers who say yes. They say, yes, I understand what you're trying to do. Let's see if we can do that. And I thought about that. I thought, well, that's interesting, but you know, maybe that's just a government thing. And like the next week, I was listening to Karen McGrain and Ethan Marcotte's interviews of the folks at Fidelity. And they were talking about how they involved lawyers in their redesign of Fidelity.com. They involved their lawyers up front, and their lawyers got involved from the very beginning to basically understand what their intention was and to start to help them navigate the complex legal world of financial regulation. They had brought these people in. And then I met this woman at the U.S. Digital Service when I was talking to them, whose job it is to figure out procurement issues. And government procurement is the big problem. It's how do I bring in folks to work with to do the work who actually are capable and not just the lowest bidder. And they were embedding procurement officers into the teams and trying to make the contract officers actually understand what it means to do this. And so this idea of having lawyers as part of your team sort of grew out of this. And this is sort of a new idea, but you know, we all have been involved in these projects where, you know, suddenly the lawyers tell you that you have to have this ugly all uppercase, I agree to the terms and conditions button that causes everybody to stop. And these guys are sort of looking at the problem saying, okay, maybe it doesn't have to be ugly. Maybe it doesn't have to be all uppercase. Maybe we could do this in another way that gets to the intention of what the rules are, but at the same time makes for a better experience. So yes, lawyers are these people who are on the legal side who are saying, yes, let's figure out a way to do that.
So do they rewrite the rules, or is this more of trying to navigate the current system that's in place?
A bit of both. We were talking with Jeff Gladshon and Tracy Walker. Jeff Gladshon's from Fidelity and Tracy Walker from the U.S. Digital Service. And one of the things they were both telling Karen and me when we were talking to them preparing for the UX Advantage Conference was that there's a difference between the law and policy. Often what happens is the law is actually very broad. It isn't that specific. But then organizations make a response to that law by creating policy. And the policy is what they decide to do going forward. So they're always consistent, so they know they can defend it, so that they know that they're within the law. But what these folks are realizing when they're trying to navigate this is that maybe some of the policies need to be revisited. And more importantly, there are occasions where you can go back to the policymakers and in some cases the lawmakers and say, we want to follow the intent of what you're trying to do, because what you're trying to do makes a lot of sense. I mean, in the case of regulation in financial services, we're protecting the investor, and that's the right thing to do. And in the case of procurement, the government is trying to spend its money wisely for the taxpayer. So both of those things everybody wants. But when you say, well, wisely means always go with the lowest bidder, suddenly you're no longer protecting the taxpayer if the lowest bidder can't do the job and you waste all that money and the project gets canceled. Or when the rules are that the investor isn't really protected because they're agreeing to terms and conditions they don't understand and they're moving forward and making mistakes anyways. So the idea is to come up with rules that actually do the things that make sense for the shareholder, for the investor, for make rules that actually make sense for the investor, for the taxpayer, and then to create policy around that that actually does the right thing. And so in both cases, they tell us that they're actively looking at new ways to interpret the policy and new ways to interpret the laws.
And does the person who's interpreting the policy and the law have to be a lawyer in this yes lawyer role?
They work with lawyers, right? So Tracy is not a lawyer. Jeff, it turns out, he's now director of product at Fidelity, but he was a lawyer. He has his JD degree. But Tracy isn't a lawyer, but she works very closely with the White House counsel. And so she is, in fact, doing those things, and they work collaboratively. So she can handle, you have to be very well versed in the law and understand where the law works and doesn't. But you also do what lawyers do, which is go seek counsel and ask opinions. And in both organizations, it seems that it's very much a team effort, which is good because that means more people are thinking about how can we creatively move through this process.
And do you think the process will result in terms that people will actually read before they click on?
Well, some of the times it'll be terms that they click on. And so sometimes it'll be translating things to plain English. Sometimes it will be embedding those things into the interface to actually say, instead of making you disclose them up front, to actually say at the time when you're trying to do something, you know, you have to make sure you file your taxes, or we're not responsible for these pieces at that moment, instead of having this upfront disclosure that tells you what they will and won't do. But then, you know, 2 months later, you don't remember what's in that thing, even if you read it, and chances are you didn't read it.
It's a really interesting concept and one that is certainly newer. One thing that struck me as you were talking is, where does this fit in to the actual user experience? Is it only in the terms and conditions, or do we see it elsewhere?
No, it's all through the interface, right? And all through the experience. There's two parts. So the stuff that Jeff is working on, which has to do with compliance and regulations, a lot of that has to do with what are called disclosures, which are the things that financial companies have to do to say, look, you're the investor. We're going to place the trade. If you lose money, it's not our fault. You can lose money. By the way, if you're investing in the stock market, you probably will lose money, right? I mean, that's the sort of things that they're disclosing. So the trick there is making sure that the shareholders are protected, that they understand that there are no safe bets. In the case of procurement, it's not so much things that are built into the interface as much as they are ways that the project happens. So if you're going to hire an organization and you want them to do truly agile development, that means that they can't predict the end game. They can't tell you what they're going to deliver when they're putting in their proposal or when they're writing the contract. So you have to write a contract that actually lets you embed the notion of exploration and innovation where you don't know what the final deliverable is. And that's completely new to contract law. We have to rethink the way contracts are written because we're not asking people to deliver a website that does X. We're asking them to work on this project that will deliver something that's useful. Those are two very different statements because we don't know if the website that does X is actually useful. So in the case of procurement, the challenge there is how do we construct an agreement so we can make sure that the team we're hiring is the right team for the job, that they understand what we're going to ask them to do, that they're going to deliver something of value without specifying what that delivery is. That's what Tracy's expertise is in, and it's fascinating.
That really is interesting, and there's some interesting parallels to another topic at the UX Advantage conference that you touched on when you mentioned the deliverable of the product. And that topic is incentives and rewards. And we know that traditional rewards and incentives are based on getting a product out of the door by a certain date or producing something within or under budget. But a question I have is, should companies be rethinking this reward and incentive process? And if so, why?
It's funny, Karen and I keep approaching the incentive and reward thing sort of in different angles, and they're both really interesting. Karen's take has a lot to do with how bonuses are allocated and how people are sort of rewarded in organizations, because we both see in our clients a lot of organizations where some senior member of the executive team has this bonus to get this thing deployed this quarter. It's got to go out this quarter. If it doesn't go out this quarter, you're not going to get your bonus, right? And because user experience often means slowing things down and really taking and asking the question, are we building the right thing? That's sort of counter to hurry up and get this thing built. And so one of the topics that we're exploring with the different industry leaders that we're bringing in is how those sort of explicit bonuses work against user experience and what they've done to counter them. The other thing that I've noticed is that there are sort of implicit rewards and bonuses that organizations build into their DNA. An example is how the budget gets allocated, right? An organization might have two separate budgets. One is for development and one is for customer support. And the managers are always fighting for more budget. They want more budget so they can have more resources so they can do their job more effectively. And is it the case that if development makes something that actually reduces support calls, by reducing support calls, they actually save money in the support budget, but they have to spend money in the development budget? And will the fact that resources are tight in development make an executive make a decision that they should do something that will increase the development budget or save money on the development side versus something that will spend more money without the reward on their side while the support people are getting the reward? And something like a password reset function, which will reduce support calls about resetting your password, might cost extra money to build. And who benefits from building that? Is it support or is it development? And so, you know, part of what we want to explore is how these rewards and incentives are key to understanding what's going on. You know, there's an old saying, which what gets measured gets done, and what gets rewarded gets done well. So how do you build rewards around great design and great experience, particularly when you're talking that you have to involve multiple departments? You know, if you're doing something in e-commerce, you very much may have a retail outlet that is rewarded for sales in the store, and you've got your online website that's rewarded for sales online. And the store actually doesn't want people to purchase online because it takes the money out of the store. And we see this happening all the time. There's one of the top businesses in the United States who has an online presence, but almost always you end up calling their support center to complete the purchase. And the reason that you call the support center to complete the purchase is because the website's very complicated. But the support center doesn't want you to fix that because their call reps actually get commissions based on those purchases. So if people actually were able to purchase online without calling the call center, their commissions would go down and they would lose their best support people. So they actually don't want to fix the experience.
It sounds like a better experience would be some of the retailers we see who you go in, you see an item you want, they don't have it in your size, you bring it up, and they will go online for you, complete the purchase, and have it shipped to your house.
Yeah, absolutely. And Kmart started this campaign a year or so ago where you can go in the store and purchase anything and they'll ship it to you. What they referred to as the ship my pants promotion. And I just shipped my pants. That's the sort of thing that's happening. This basic rethinking of how are those rewards done? You know, if the store is rewarded on sales and their salespeople are sending people to the website, that doesn't benefit the store and a store manager who's competing and getting bonuses based on these things. So these are the types of things that we're very interested in. And as we've been talking to the various folks like Bill Scott from PayPal and Karen Pasco from MasterCard, we've been sort of exploring what those rewards and issues are within their organization that they have to sort of work through and say, okay, we need to reward the whole organization for success, not just each individual group for its own success, so that we stop them from competing against each other in a way that makes a worse user experience.
It sounds like a really complex problem, because if you look at the incentives and rewards, are you able to differentiate if one is more important than the other? Because if you're incentivizing one group, but there's an overall reward, how do we measure the value of that incentive related to the individual reward? Or are there levels of each one that come together to make the whole? I guess essentially I'm asking, is one more important than the other, the incentive or the reward?
I think that that's an excellent question. I think that the reward or the incentive, I'm not sure that semantically they're that different, right? But in both cases, there's a carrot on a stick. And the question is, are they causing the organization to move in the right direction, right? And a lot of the incentives that organizations have built in were built years ago. And they work against this sort of new economy where customers are choosing to purchase from lots of different places and not necessarily going straight to a single location. You know, when I do banking, I might go into a branch, but I also do a lot of my banking online. And does the branch get rewarded for opening an account? Or should the business as a whole get rewarded for opening accounts? If someone walks into the branch, finds out everything they need, and opens the account at home, does the branch get penalized for that? And in the old days, when they were counting how many new accounts we opened, that's how branches were rewarded. The ones that opened the most new accounts got the monthly bonus, got the award, got the plaque in the office, whatever it was, got the recognition for being the leader in that division. And that has to be rethought. And so where we see this problem mostly happening are in the older businesses, the ones that predate online experiences, predate digital experiences. The systems are trying to adapt, but they haven't gotten there yet. And so the conversations we're going to have with folks is about how have they dealt with that. I mean, MasterCard is way older than the web. And so now that MasterCard is competing against things like Apple Pay and Square, how does that change the incentives for signing up new merchants? How does that change the incentives for delivering customer service? How does that help the MasterCard cardholder get access to their account and be able to use the services such that they don't switch to somebody else's credit card?
That's a fascinating topic as well, the incentives and rewards, along with the invention of the Yes Lawyer, which are only two of the topics at the UX Advantage Conference. I want to thank you for your time today, Jared.
I want to thank you for your time today, Sean.
All right, and watch for other podcasts covering more of the conference topics, and be sure to check out the conference speakers and all the topics at uxadvantage.com. We hope to see you in Baltimore on August 18th and 19th.
For more information about the UX Advantage Conference, visit uxadvantage.com. As always, thanks for listening.